and welcome to Unjustly Maligned, the show for people who go against the grain. We seek to rehabilitate the overlooked, ignored, derided, or the just plain hated. Movies, novels, music, comic books, video games, whatever. If everyone hates it, or even just doesn't know it exists, we'll find someone who loves it and let them explain why you should too. I'm your host, Anthony Johnston, and my guest today is the game designer and musician, and no relation, Matt Johnston. Matt, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
So please tell us what you have come on the show to talk about. Give us some context around its development, its release, its reception, why it is maligned, and why you believe that that is wrong.
All right. So what I've come to defend is the video game called No Man's Sky. It was developed by a small team called Hello Games. They are based in Britain. And over the course of 4 years... three and a half, 4 years. They've been working on this this game. It was shown in very early development at an E3 in 2013, and then various videos have come out since then. What the game is a very open-ended space and planet exploration game where you can travel between an almost infinite number of planets and land on the planets and then walk around and, figure out what kind of animals live there and earn some money and upgrade your ship. There's not much by the way of plot, but there's a whole lot of lore, which is one of the reasons I like it. The launch for this game was absolutely, positively a disaster, which I'm sure we'll get into.
Yeah.
Especially for the PC. So it was dual developed for the PlayStation 4 and for the PC. The PlayStation 4 release was okay. It had a lot of bugs with the servers not being up and that sort of thing. It's not a multiplayer game, which again is part of the controversy, but the PC release was very, very buggy. And I think that's where most of where it is maligned kind of comes from. That and that first video they showed in 2013. In 2013, they showed what was basically what they call kind of a bullshot video, which is pre-rendered, or if it was in-game, it was very, very trimmed and made to look pretty and exactly the type of experience, like the ultimate experience of the game. But it is not what a lot of players got at the launch, and as a result, there was a lot of outcry from the players. While the critics' reviews were okay, the player reviews were really, really negative, and it was mostly because they couldn't see what was shown in that first trailer, whether it was giant space sandworms like Dune or a giant Brontosaurus diplodocus type of dinosaur or a charging space rhino. Like there was so much in that first trailer that just was not in the game at launch that the player reviews were exceedingly negative, especially on Steam, where you could put in your detailed reviews. And so many people pre-ordered the game that it kind of blew up. And once it died down, then, I mean... It was definitely, I would say, justly maligned was that launch, absolutely. The game itself, though, is so much fun. And that's, when you get down to it, when you tear away all of the cruft of the launch being buggy and the game not yet being what they showed in that first trailer, I think the game itself is just a ton of fun as an exploration game, a super relaxing game, although now it can be a little more stressful because they've kind of added some different game modes where if you die, you just die. That's it. Permadeath, as they say. So that's kind of where I am coming from as like this super fan who was there at launch. And like, this is the game I've wanted since I was 10 years old. So I'm definitely 100% biased in favor of this game. Like, I came in ready to love the game, and for me, I wasn't disappointed, but I definitely see where a lot of folks, especially at that launch, were livid, and understandably so.
Right. So your contention is basically if you just come to the game cold, without all of the hype and without false expectations, essentially, then, you know, you're saying it is, on its own terms, a good and enjoyable game. It's just there was, and I'm sure most people who've heard of the game would agree, you know, the reason that it is maligned, even I know, and I knew very little about this game, to be perfectly honest, but even I knew that the complaints people had were mostly because they perceived, at any rate, that the developers just simply lied.
Yeah.
You know, just outright claimed stuff would be in the game, and it just wasn't, at least when the game was released. They did, you know, in game terms, did a Molyneux.
Yeah, exactly. And I, it's tough. I see where that, and I don't want to sound like a lawyer, I definitely see where that is the case for a ton of people. I do wonder how much of those expectations were self-created, though. I know in a couple of instances, he had said, oh yeah, there is going to be a type of multiplayer. And there was none of that at launch. Like, the first day, two players, and let me say that the galaxies are millions and billions of planets.
Right, isn't it like, I think I saw the figure 19 quintillion planets in each galaxy or something.
Oh, it's so much smaller than that. No, it's only 56 quadrillion per galaxy.
Oh, is that all?
Yeah, yeah. But there's 256 galaxies.
Right.
So it is that huge number. It's meant to be like, and that was one of the big selling points is, oh, this is so infinite, you may never run into another player. There is a type of multiplayer, but you'll never run into him. And of course, because of like little development tricks they had to do right as launch was about to happen to kind of shortcut and make some features work, everybody kind of started in the same group of star systems. And so two players saw each other. Well, they saw that they were on the same planet, two Reddit users, and they tried to see each other, and they couldn't see each other. And that blew up into, oh my goodness, there's no multiplayer. This is horrible. We have been lied to. And since then, in subsequent updates, there has been some really great work, I think, in this like asynchronous multiplayer where you can see, you build a base and on a planet and another player can see your base on the planet, but you never see each other, which in my personal opinion is a really great design implementation, given how ridiculously difficult it would be to have synchronized multiplayer where you see each other or you shoot at each other or whatever, over the fact that you have hundreds of thousands of game owners, you know, the sold something like 200,000 or 800,000 copies on Steam and another 1.6 million on PS4.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And that was, again, I think one of the reasons the outcry was so huge was they had a launch many, many, many times larger than they expected it to. But they had that huge launch because they were hyping that video, or they were, you know, every time the creator, the main director, Sean Murray, would come on to, you know, some game developer conference or some E3 over the next, you know, while they were in development, it was like watching a Steve Jobs presentation. Like, people were flocking and like doing the criminology about what, you know, he said this, he said these four words in this order, that obviously means that there's going to be giant space whales, you know? So it's just one of those that it just got out of control. Like, if you only have 12 people on the team,
right, it's like a 15-person studio or something, isn't it?
Yeah, and for most of the development, there was only like 6 or 7 of them working on it.
Oh,
wow. It was just at the end where they kind of, when they were hitting, you know, that last push where everybody's on 24-hour days and all of that sort of thing to hit that deadline, they hired a whole bunch more people. A whole bunch, of course, meaning another 8, right?
Yeah, relatively, yeah. Just a quick aside, talking about the bullshots and stuff, and I mean, this is why you get, you know, for listeners who aren't sort of avid gamers, this is why when you see a TV commercial for something like, say, Halo or Gears of War, there's a big, you know, not actual gameplay images banner, yeah, at the bottom of the screen, because what you're seeing is pre-rendered stuff that is not what you're going to see when you play the game. So, you know, there's been this understanding for years in the industry that screenshots are tweaked and sometimes photoshopped, cleaned up in Photoshop to look nice for presentations and what have you. And, you know, people kind of understand that to an extent, I think. I think there's a certain amount of, you know, fine, okay, whatever. But you can't stray too far from that, exactly. Especially if you're showing people what you purport to be gameplay. And this just came to mind because you mentioned how people were treating Sean Murray's appearances like Kremlinology with Steve Jobs' appearances and stuff. And Jobs famously used to do this sort of thing. The iPhone presentation, this came out a few years ago. I don't know if you, or maybe only a year or two ago. I don't know if you remote saw this, that the first iPhone presentation, when Steve Jobs got on stage and demonstrated the very first pre-launch iPhone, the software demonstration that he did was kind of like that, in not that it was pre-rendered, but that it was built to do exactly what he did and nothing more. Like, if he'd touched any icon other than the ones he did, if he'd tried to do anything other than what he demonstrated on stage, the phone would have crashed.
Yeah, exactly. And that's exactly what that first trailer for No Man's Sky was it was advertised, and really was, because they found assets in the game code, that it was in-game rendered, right? It wasn't pre-rendered necessarily, but it was designed to walk down this one path.
Yeah.
Over here, see the giant dinosaur, look over here, see the giant rhino charge, get in the ship and leave the planet. Like, that's all that game code could do
exactly
in 2013.
It's same sort of thing, yeah. And what I was going to say was, the difference is that when the iPhone launched, you could do everything that Steve Jobs had demonstrated on stage, and it worked. I think that's the thing. As long people accept that sort of thing happens, but as long as you follow through on what you release is capable of doing what you've shown, then I think people are more willing to forgive it. But yeah, in a case like this where, you know, creatures like that just simply don't exist, or you'll never see that combination of that sort of creature with this sort of planetary artifact or whatever, it's, yeah, you know, if there's a general perception that, hang on a second, you know, they've thrown everything in here, you never see all of this at once, that's when people start getting antsy.
Yeah, exactly. And it's steadily improved with the different, and there was some game mechanics too, right? That were in that trailer. I don't want to get hung up on this too much, but you know, there was a couple of game mechanics which probably are coming in the future. This is a game that is still being, after almost a year,
it's in active development, isn't it? Yeah,
active updates and development. This is not like little patches, although they're doing little patches. They're sticking giant sections of content, but you know, originally in that and the other thing about the Steve Jobs presentation, of course, was it wasn't 3 years before the game came out.
Yes, also true.
Or before the iPhone came out. So you know, it's just one of those things where some folks were more forgiving of it, some folks really held them to the fire on that sort of thing. But there's so much that the game in and of itself gets right. The soundtrack is absolutely fantastic. 65 Days of Static was, like, they used one of their existing tracks for that first trailer, Hello Games did, and then asked 65 Days of Static if they would do the full soundtrack for the game, and they agreed, and it's an hour and a half of really fantastic kind of post-rock, post-metal music. Absolutely some of the best that they've done.
Well, and it isn't the in-game music generative to an extent as well?
To an extent, yeah, they do kind of like what they did with Skyrim, with some of the ambient sounds mixing in with some music. They take 4-bar snippets or 2-bar snippets loop them in interesting ways. It sounds great, and they're adding more of that with each update too. They added 3 or 4, 8 maybe new ambient tracks. So while you're on planets, you hear these ambient tracks, and it's really fantastic. So every time they update the game, you get a bunch of new stuff, and it's free. They haven't done any DLC yet. Although, never say never, right?
Right, but I think at this stage, you know, really they couldn't. I mean, this is the other thing. This is a full-priced game, which, again, as you say, originally it probably wasn't going to be, because it's an indie studio, and they thought that they were making an indie game. So, and again, I don't know a lot about this, but I you know, enough to be dangerous. So let's rewind a little and tell us about that path to development? Because as I understand it, this was, because they get the final games published by Sony, but as I understand it, that was not the case to start with. This was, wasn't it even a Kickstarter or something?
No, it wasn't a Kickstarter. Thank God it was not a Kickstarter.
okay.
Because Sean Murray might not be with us. Because it's absolutely, you know those Kickstarter backers.
I do.
Yeah. I emailed a guy about a watch I didn't get for 4 years. Anyway, so yeah, the development was, it started out as a hobby. They were working on another game for mobile called Joe Danger.
Oh, I know that, yeah.
Yeah, and they had Joe Danger and Joe Danger 2. And those two kind of like were successful in the early days of the App Store and of Steam. And they really kind of gave them enough money to start developing this procedurally generated engine as a hobby. And so they worked on that for a long time. And then, yeah, they got in touch with, and I want to say it was after that E3 video that they were still indie, completely like, oh, it'll come out for PC someday, you know. At that point, and then Sony came to him and said, holy free holies, this is absolutely amazing. We will help you out. We will market the game. We will make sure you have kind of what you need for marketing and publishing. All you need to do is tune it for the PS4. The PS4 is the new console at the time, and we want this to really show off that you can do something infinite and amazing on the PS4. We need a big space game.
Well, and unlike the PS3, by all accounts, the PS4 is actually fairly sort of regular and easy to program for as well. So I don't imagine that was, not saying it wasn't work, but
yeah.
You know, not as much work as it would have been to do it on, say, the PS3 or something.
Right. And so the major advantage is they probably, you know, they were not doing major changes to switch from development for the PC to the PS4 because, you know, the modern console era are all basically PCs, just in different configurations.
Right. Just with massive GPUs and, yeah, dedicated loads of RAM and stuff. Yeah. Or actually, exactly. No, not much RAM, but yeah. Dedicated ways of getting around that.
Exactly. So they developed and they really started down that path of focusing on the PS4 build. The PC build, I think we saw at launch, was kind of second because you have to configure for a ton of different hardware, right? Whereas with the PS4, it's just like doing something for the iPhone where, well, it used to be before they had a bunch of different configurations of the iPhone as well.
But PC users, PC gamers at the best of times are often quite sore if when, you know, a game doesn't perform as well on the PC as on a console. And exactly. In a case like this, where they were told it was originally going to be a PC game, and then those evil console people stepped in and threw money at them and, you know, took them away, lured them over to the dark side of console gaming, they must have been livid.
Absolutely livid. And then when their launch, which came 3 days later than the console launch. So it launched August 9th for the PS4 and didn't launch until August 12th for the PC. So, okay, now they're waiting. But while they've waited, and everybody's pre-ordered this game, while they've waited, they're seeing the bugs in the PS4 launch, and they're like, oh, well, it should be better for us. They've been developing for the PC longer. And then their launch was worse. And so that kind of really set them against, like, in opposition to the company.
It's like a perfect storm of how to annoy PC gamers, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And it's like, oh, don't worry. You're slightly less special than the console gamers because you're running more expensive hardware. And also, it didn't launch great. But then, you know, we're going to take a step back and they were really good. They released patches. I think they released 3 patches the first week. Like, they were really working basically 24/7 to get all that fixed. But that marketing, that Sony marketing machine, right, really gets you a ton of people buying the game.
Oh, yeah.
And if you're not ready for 2 million people in the first week to have your game server-wise or, you know, customer service-wise, et cetera, then you look like you're hosed. And that they came back. And they released, you know, several patches in the first couple of weeks. They went to work, and 3 months after the launch, they released a huge update that changed the universe. They changed the procedural generation algorithm for the terrain. And so planets looked different, and more like richly wrinkled and terrainy.
Oh, that's right. I saw a video comparing the before and after. There's things like horizon, draw distance occlusion and stuff, you know, atmospheric occlusion. And there's HDR lighting, I believe, now on planets.
Yep, and God rays and all of that good stuff. The things they've done, in fact, that most recent. So they've had two really big patches, the Pathfinder patch is the second one, and it's basically like an HD remaster of its own game for free. You know how they remaster PS3 games for better graphics, like Last of Us had that and all that sort of thing. They basically did that. They upped the texture quality. They increased the color and the changed a bunch of the filtering, and everything looks better. And there's motion blur. And they, as they are learning how their engine works, because they wrote their own engine from scratch, they're getting better at making it work for everybody, and then adding a bunch of cool stuff. A couple of things that have happened, you know, so it's a game without a plot. So they're, but they are adding, you know, quests in that you build a base, and there are people you hire for your base, and they send you out on small quests. You know, it's not like there's, you are the savior of the universe or anything like that in this game. I think actually that's one of the big draws for me, is that you are very small in the game.
Right. It gets over the vastness of the universe, and, you know, the old Douglas Adams, space is big, really, really big.
Exactly. You know, you wouldn't believe. Exactly. Yeah. And that's exactly kind of the point of view I love about that game, is we have a ton of Flash Gordon games, right? We have a ton of, you are the most awesome being in the universe, and here is your super awesome ship, and you are going to save the world every time you go to a planet. Lots of kind of pretending to be Captain Kirk. What I like about No Man's Sky in particular is you are an, what they call you, the interloper, right? Or the traveler. You have no name. You are yourself, right? There's no player model to see. It's completely first person.
Right. And nobody addresses you by a fictional name or anything.
Exactly. Which I think is absolutely, for me, it sucks me in even harder into that game universe. And there's, so when I was a kid, and I think we're of similar eras. So I used to play a game called Starflight on the Commodore 64. It was on a bunch of different game systems and computers. And it was open-ended exploration. You had your ship, and it had a crew, and you had to learn different alien languages as you were going along. So you would interact with aliens, and they would speak this language you didn't understand. And as you got better, as you interacted with them more, you would learn the language a little bit more. And it encouraged you to explore the universe and explore the lore and the plot of the game. This, to me, feels like kind of a spiritual successor. You have not a lot of different races, but you have three different ones, and they have hundreds of words to learn. And you can direct your gameplay to say, I want to interact with these aliens. So I'm going to seek out places where these aliens gather, and I will learn their language. Or you can, you can do a million different things. So for me, it always felt like I was getting the game I played as a 10-year-old. But the way I saw it in my imagination, in that full color, in the 3D.
Right.
You know.
Right, because Starflight, it should be just mentioned to people who aren't familiar with games history, came out, like, I think 2 years after Elite.
Yes.
You know, which famously was, I think, Elite wasn't that the first game ever to use wireframe graphics. So that gives you some idea of how primitive we're talking in terms of the graphics and sound and what have you. But as you say, when you're a kid, doesn't matter, and especially with, you know, what was then brand new, highly advanced technology, it doesn't matter because it's all taking place in your head.
Exactly. And so, you know, one of the things I used to do as a 10-year-old was like flip through my parents' 1970s copy of the Starfleet Technical Manual, the unofficial fan one, and I'd pick a scout ship, like they had randomly named scout ships that were not the Enterprise, and I'd sit in a chair and I'd have the Star Trek the Motion Picture soundtrack playing on my cassette tape player, and I would pretend to explore the universe. And so, you know, coming from that mindset, this game like hit every button for just bringing that to life. And I think for folks, because I will say, okay, the game is maligned by a lot of people or ignored by a lot of people now, right?
Yeah.
Where they bought the game, it was completely disappointing. They uninstalled it or they put it in their shelf and they've never played it again. But for a select few, right, a few thousand of us, you can see on Steam, a few thousand play like massive amounts of this game every week. I think it really hits that button where you're like, this game is self-indulgent and slow in the way it presents itself to you. It is it's relaxing, where a lot of games are really driven by plot and conflict. There's no plot whatsoever. I'll take that back. There is a small plot that takes about 2 hours to 5 hours to complete, but the game lasts as long as you want it to, right? After that is over, it's not like it's game over. You just keep going.
Well, and those 5 hours are also, it's not like you can do them in a single 5 hour block, is it? They're spread out over.
Yeah, you have to build up some resources and get to the next star system that has the next plot point. So, you know, it has all the trappings of kind of a Skyrim, but even less of those necessity of plot, right? Like Skyrim has a ton of side quests and then this one thread of a plot. This has the one thread of a plot and then wide open spaces for you to just wander.
And almost no side quests. Yeah.
And almost no side quests. They're getting more, but you know, it's like, do you wait 3 months and then there's some more, or do you, you play it as is? I've probably dumped, you know, 500 hours into this game just wandering around.
Wow.
Just wandering around.
Wow.
I have never played a game so much. I never finish games, and this game is perfect because I could never finish it anyway.
I mean, that's crazy. Like, mm-hmm. the my most played game ever is Burnout Paradise. And I think when I hit 110 hours in that, I thought, do you know what? That's probably enough. but yeah, I mean, from what I've seen of, and like, I haven't played this game, but I've watched a few videos on YouTube. I've read a bit up about it in preparation for the show. From what I've seen, I would say, to use one of my beloved music analogies, this is to Mass Effect as Brian Eno is to a Genesis album or something. It's,
yes,
you know, it seems as if you can be as engaged in terms of learning lore and encountering alien races or not as you want to be. And that's why I make the comparison with Eno. Famously, he said of ambient music, the idea is that it's as listenable as it is ignorable. You can pay as much attention to it as you like or pay it no attention whatsoever, and it works in both scenarios. And it seems like this game is kind of, I mean, certainly it seems like it's aiming for that, and it sounds like it's, for you at least, it's achieved it. And
yeah,
I think part of that might come from what you just said about how you sort of grew up, you know, dreaming of piloting spaceships and stuff, didn't we all? Or all of our generation at least. And I remember reading something about Sean Murray, the lead developer, where he said that what he wanted to do with this game was capture the sense he had as a child from science fiction magazines that he grew up reading in the 70s and 80s, like, you know, yeah. Asimov's and Amazing Stories and all those sorts of, you know, and the crazy Chris Foss artwork and stuff that you'd get on those magazines of these impossible alien worlds that defied the laws of physics and gravity and, you know, amazing tales of space exploration and stuff. And that was the kind of the feel of encountering that fiction. And I think, you know, most of us who grew up as SF fans know that feeling. You know, we may get it from something specifically different to that, but we know how that feels. And he said that that's the feeling he was trying to capture with this game. And yeah, it sounds like for you, at least, he's achieved that.
Yeah, absolutely. I it's funny that you mentioned Brian Eno. The parallel I was always making with my friends was, this is to video games, this is Tales from Topographic Oceans, right? Like, this can be interesting or as boring as you want it to be. And some people think that album is absolutely a snore. But for me, I just dig in. Tales is my favorite Yes album, which it should be its own episode. But but absolutely, like, it is one of the things that the main community on, like, say, Reddit does is share screenshots. And the thing is to mock up a screenshot that looks as much like a 70s sci-fi book cover as you can get.
Oh, right. Try and make something that looks like a Yes album cover or something. Yeah,
yeah, exactly.
A Michael Whelan painting, maybe.
Exactly. And you know what's crazy is, and they didn't have to do this, but they did seed, like, floating islands and stuff that shouldn't work, you know, as far as gravity and physics and whatnot. So they're really trying to give you as much of a visual aesthetic experience as they can, because the whole kind of goal for Sean Murray and for that game is, I want to have something interesting as I walk over a hill and I walk into a valley over this, you know, like, tall blue grass or red grass, and you're walking over the hill and you see something interesting, some crazy alien structure or some naturally occurring rock formation that could never happen on Earth. You know, that's like the moment that makes the game worthwhile. Like, you play it for an hour and you get one of those, this amazing sunset comes over the trees, and, you know, you get an aesthetic experience that's really enjoyable. And you think to yourself, my God, I'm on an alien planet today and I saw the coolest thing. You know, it's not necessarily about, I shot down 15 pirates and I got, you know, 500 million space dollars, you know.
Yeah.
Which is fine. That's a great game too. It's just not this game.
Yeah, frankly, looking at these videos, I was kind of disappointed to see that you even have a gun. You know, I was kind of like, yeah, really? Yeah. You know, was that strictly necessary? But okay, this does, again, from having watched a few videos and stuff, I mean, yes, I saw lots of the sort of alien physics-defying artifacts and stuff. They do seem to be fairly common, and they look fantastic. You're right. They look great. It gives you a very strong sense of otherworldliness and this feeling of exploring alien worlds. Although I will say, you kind of get to see patterns after a while, even though, and you know, again, mm-hmm. we should say this is procedurally generated. So in theory, no two planets are the same and every planet has the capability to be different. However, most of them do seem to consist of mostly rocky terrain with big lumbering quadruped animals walking around, you know. With various different colors and stripes and what have you. But there is that sense of there's clearly a bit of a pattern going on there. However, that aside, one thing that I was surprised about, and this ties into what you said before about how there's no story as such, but there is lore. But I think for me, I would want more lore. You know, I mean, I'm a narrative focused guy and I like games with a story. That's my bias. I make no apologies for that. However, I could get into a game like this, except there doesn't seem to be, like, I saw videos of, you know, guys landing on planets and seeing these incredibly weird and, you know, strange looking structures, very alien, very interesting. And they'd go and wander around them. And then there's nothing, you know, they wander around them and that's it. And there's nothing to actually learn or see there. And on the one hand, I can appreciate the idea that, you know, not every ruined monument is going to have an explanatory plaque next to it, you know, sponsored by the Galactic Commission telling you who used to live here. On the other hand, if you're going to show me like amazing looking ruins that are from some civilization that's long dead, I'd like to be able to learn more about them. That's part of, for me, that's part of what makes it, that concept, interesting. And it seems like there's not a lot of that. So what is the lore? What do you actually find out in this game?
So, okay, so that is really interesting. And I do, so you mentioned the little space plaques. Most of the lore is presented to you basically in space plaque form, where you will go to a monument or you will go to an abandoned factory. There's a couple of storylines that go through. So you'll land, and you'll see a monument, or you'll wander and you'll find a monument, and you can go to the interaction point. And it is a lot of text. There is a storyline, a history of each of the three alien races, the Korvax, the Vikeen, who are your Klingons, lizard-looking guys, and the Gek. The Korvax are, they all look like Daft Punk extras. The Gek are little kind of beaked alien guys. They're the traitors, the Ferengi, if you will.
Oh, yeah, I saw lots of screens of them, yeah, haggling, selling and buying stuff, yeah.
Exactly. So each of those monuments will have, and this is interesting, I find it interesting that a lot of the videos you interacted with maybe didn't show that plaque, so to speak, because technically all of them do have one, except maybe if a PC user has modified the game and they've put in a bunch of structures that just don't have interaction.
No, I think all the videos I watched were PS4.
Oh, good, 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 good. So maybe they weren't interacting with it. Technically, you should. There is an interaction point with every one of those little monuments. So you interact, you get history, you learn a couple new words out of their language, which means the gibberish that you receive when you're interacting with one of them, because you can, when you enter a star system and you land on the space station or on the planet, you can encounter other ships. So, you know, the aliens will fly their ships around the system in a procedural path, and you can buy a ship from any alien that's flying a ship. You can buy their ship out from under them. You can, you know, buy and sell stuff. And generally, they will have a little sentence that they say, or, you know, a piece of information that they have that's, if you don't know the language, it's hidden behind the gibberish. But as you learn words, then you start to get the words. There is the main storyline is, and the plot, as it were, is that... you have been asked, and you can turn it down immediately, which is very interesting. But when you find your crashed ship, you are asked by a very mysterious alien that is not one of the races, an alien presence, to find them. And so you interact with the monuments, and you learn the lore, and then you are kind of directed or told to go to this system that is the next Atlas system, and you encounter an Atlas space station, which looks like that diamond shape that's on the cover of the game. Mm-hmm. And it's massive, like V'ger, you know, from the motion picture. Another movie I really like, which might be kind of why my brain is wired to like this game. And you enter, and this gigantic red pulsating sphere tells you that you are a sheep and you are meant to do their work on in this universe, and you must follow them. And if you follow this very intimidating and scary presence in this giant alien space station, you are rewarded with stuff to continue your mission. As you continue through 10 or 12, I think it's 10, of these interactions with the Atlas, you learn more about kind of the sci-fi plot of the game, which is that the Atlas is extra dimensional, and the universe itself is a simulation, and you are in their simulation, which kind of puts Sean Murray as God, as the Atlas in this yeah. game, which is very which meta. Is I think very cheeky and meta of them to do, and exactly the sort of like, oh hey, guess what, you know, it was a game the entire time and you've been playing it. I personally didn't like the plot of that. I got it and I understood it and I thought, eh, that, you know, okay, that's fine. The best part is once you're done, you have the entire universe, which either you accept as a simulation or not as a simulation, and you can just explore. So that's the plot. And then you have the lore, which is like 1,100 words of the three different alien languages to learn, and 300 or 400 little paragraphs to read. And that's like one thing I think maybe could improve in the future. And I put this out as a in the future because you never know. They seem to still be actively developing. And so it's still fun to kind of have a wish list, is maybe less just presented space plaques of this is the ruin of X, and a little more interacting with people and learning about a story through interactions with the aliens themselves.
Right. Getting into conversations rather than effectively reading books on, you know, history lessons. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Because, you know, Skyrim has that too. They stick all their lore mm-hmm. basically in libraries full of these books. And some folks love to read that. I personally actually don't like to read that lore.
Oh, no. I know folks who spend hours reading books in Skyrim. It's, yeah.
Exactly. It's one of those deals that when you get a game that big, like a Skyrim or a No Man's Sky, you have to kind of accommodate 5 or 6 different play styles. Folks who like to wander and do this, folks who like to, you know, collect. Or one of the things I really enjoy doing is playing National Geographic or Intergalactic Geographic Explorer. And you can scan and catalog all the animals on a planet, and you get a ton of money if you successfully do that. Generally, there's 6 to 10 species on a planet, which is small, right? But it makes for a game that is kind of self-contained within the game. You land on a planet, you spend a couple of hours trying to find all the creatures, you get a reward, and you move on to the next planet. That's my favorite way to play. Some people like to play as a space pirate and try to blow up every ship they see, and that's a mechanic that started out kind of poor, but has gotten a lot better over the updates. So, you know, when you get a big game like this, you have to accommodate a ton of different styles of play.
Well, that's something I was going to bring up, was the sort of ship combat aspect, because I believe this is, again, something that was kind of, I don't know whether it was promised or just heavily implied, but players seemed to at least be expecting that you could, you know, warp into a system or whatever, and you might suddenly land in the middle of a big battle between, you know, freighter starships and stuff, having a fight and firing missiles at one another, and you could join in if you wanted or not, if you didn't want to, and that you could basically take part in these big, massive ship-to-ship space battles. And then that just wasn't there, at least in the first release of the game at all.
Yeah, at the first release, it was, I'm trying to remember now if I saw it before, like, the fourth patch or not, but it was very basic. Ship combat was simplified, and I thank them for this, because I am a dirty, dirty casual as far as Twitch gameplay, which is why I almost exclusively play role-playing games.
Right.
Ship combat is very simple. There's a very forgiving auto aim. You can basically hover in your combat ship if you do it right, and the ships will come at you and wait to be killed, you know, that sort of thing. You can improve your ship with expansions for your weapons, improvements for your weapons and your shields to make yourself almost indestructible. It started out too easy, And I think, especially with PC gamers who are used to like first-person shooters or space combat games in general, they found it so easy that it was almost not worth their while. In subsequent updates, they've really done a good job of improving the enemy combat artificial intelligence. They've done a good job of making the ship a little bit harder to do, to steer, but not like clumsy. And they did add warping into a system, and there is a pirate attack on a freighter. And now if you rescue the freighter will give you, you can land inside the freighter, which you couldn't do when it first came out, and you can hire the freighter and it can be yours, or they'll give you, you know, some very large gift as a thank you for rescuing them.
So oh, right.
They've really, and I it's going to be interesting as it progresses, they've really done an interesting job of taking the visuals that they have always had. You know, the freighters have always kind of warped in right after you, but you couldn't interact with them, and then adding interaction points with them. So you can see, I bet you, and this is just speculation on my part, I bet you they needed another year for development because they had delayed it once, and folks were not terribly happy about the delay because it was supposed to come out in June of 2016 and it ended up coming out in August.
Yeah, and that was crazy. I mean, I remember that at the time, and I couldn't quite get my head around why people were absolutely like foaming at the mouth about a 2-month delay. Wasn't that when Sean Murray started getting death threats?
Yes.
For an 8-week delay, for heaven's sake.
An 8-week delay over spring break. So you imagine all those teenagers or over summer break. And I imagine it's like, oh, I was planning on playing this my entire summer break, and I'm not forgiving it by any means. But the hype had gotten so huge by June that my parents were keeping up with it. Like, my parents wanted to play this game, and they're like, Matt, just tell me when it's going to come out. We'll buy a PlayStation 4 when it comes out, and we'll play this game. Like, this game will be the No Man's Sky, or this PlayStation will only play No Man's Sky. I'm like, sure, no problem. And I told them it was delayed 8 weeks, and they were disappointed. They were really disappointed. So the hype had gotten ubiquitous by that point, by the time June had come around, because they were doing, I want to say almost monthly, they were doing presentations at conferences, and then they were starting to get on talk shows. He was on Colbert. Played the game for Stephen Colbert. Like, it got huge and bigger and bigger and bigger. And every time the fans would ask, is he going to announce the release date yet? Is he going to announce the release date yet? And like in April or something, they announced the release date as June and then almost immediately delayed it 2 months. So I really want to say that like the game that came out in August was a skeleton of the game. It was the minimum viable product. If you take a list of features, and anybody who has a JOB job knows this, right? You say this is what the game, or this is what the product needs to be, and what can we short circuit or just take out until the game can ship, and just so the game will ship. And so you spoke about like the planets being kind of the same and samey. Any planet could have been the starting point for a player, which means that first little mission of fixing your ship requires you to gather some elements, plutonium and zinc and, you know, fantasy elements like iridium or whatever. You have to go mine, so it's a little bit of a tutorial. But that meant every planet had to have those, which means every planet started to be kind of the same.
Yeah, yeah, I can see that. I've seen people, the general, amongst people who were, you know, sort of greatly disappointed, the general consensus opinion is that Sony rushed them to release it, that, you know, Sony pumped all this money into the game and then they were like, okay, and now you've got to hit this release date, and that's why the first version was terrible. Now there's probably a grain of truth in that, but on the other hand, having, you know, as someone who's been involved in game development from the other side, as it were, from the inside, I think people who have never seen, been involved in game development, sort of overestimate things, the impact of that sort of thing, because I am, and again, obviously, who knows, you know, we'd have to go to an alternate dimension to find out the truth, but I would wager that even if Sony had said, it's okay, take another 12 months, the game probably still wouldn't have had much more in it when it released, because that's not how game development works, basically. I don't think that giving them another 6 months or 12 months would have made all that much difference. I suspect that a lot of this iterative improvement that you're seeing now with the graphical improvements, and I know there have been gameplay changes, not just things like the piracy that you mentioned and space battles, but also things like you can now have rovers, you know, like vehicles on the planets that you control, which wasn't in the first version. That wouldn't have been in the first version anyway. I can almost guarantee that that was never going to be in the first version, no matter how long it had been delayed. so, yeah, I think a lot of that stuff, a lot of the improvements are probably coming about because they shipped. And now, not that the pressure's off, because clearly we, after the reception, the pressure was very much not off. But it's, you know, it's a milestone. It's like, okay, the game's out. Now we can concentrate on all the things that we couldn't focus on because we were so obsessed with actually making the game work and getting it out there. You know, that's how development is. That's just, that's a fact of development life. And unfortunately, if you, because so many people don't understand that, and I think this is a real problem, a genuine problem in game development, is too many game developers forget that their audience, because their audience is very technically savvy, they forget that their audience doesn't actually know how game development works. And so are, yes, a bit loose-lipped, frankly.
Yeah, exactly.
And say things they shouldn't say, and say things off the cuff that sound like promises, and forget that their audience don't, like anybody in the games industry, hears that sort of stuff and goes, we'll see, you know, and then and then isn't disappointed if that stuff isn't in the game, because we all know how difficult this industry is. But if you forget that most of your audience isn't going to react that way, and they're going to take you at your word, that's when you start getting problems. You know, again, that's the Molyneux syndrome.
Yeah, exactly.
It's, yeah, you have to be really careful about, you know, what you promise. So yeah, I think that even if Sony had not supposedly, you know, even if they did rush them to release, I don't think it actually made all that much difference. And frankly, I don't think they probably did rush them. Given 3 years, even for a small team, 3 years is a good development time. You know, there are very few games that need more than 3 years to be made. Now, I'm not saying, you know, there have been lots of games that have taken more than 3 years, and some of them have been okay at the end of it. But of those games, almost none of them needed more than 3 years. In most of those cases, you'll find that those games actually, if they were doing development for, like, say, 6 or 7 years, what actually happened was that they were developed three times over, and everything that had been done before was thrown out, and they started all over again. You know, there's no reason that any game should take longer than 3 years to develop, really.
I would say, in general, absolutely, for sure. I think what happened is, if you count the 3 years, you're counting at least 1 year for just developing the engine and the ability to develop
itself. Yeah.
Right. So, and honestly, they've changed the actual engine a couple times since then. So you have to think that, okay, like, we got as far for MVP for this, and then we got as far as minimum viable product for the assets, which you're talking about, like the types of animals you can create with the procedural generation, because those are way more artistically kind of like developed rather than like truly mathematically developed. There are pieces that you kind of put together, a headpiece here and an eye stalk here, and all of that has to be done by an artist. So you have, I think, all the tools had to be built first. And so when we say like a 3 year development cycle, yes, it's a 3 year development cycle, but it's not like Duke Nukem Forever,
right,
where they had an existing engine and just tweaked and tweaked and tweaked and tweaked and tweaked until they ran out of beer money, and then tried again, and then tried again, and then tried again. You know, this is, I think this is one of those cases where I'm willing to give them the benefit of the doubt. Again, completely and utterly biased because they delivered a childhood dream for me, to say, yeah, it took 3 years, and then you delivered like literally just the bones and some skin on it. Now you're putting meat on it, and I feel a lot better.
Right. Now you're spending another 3 years actually building it up into the game that, you know, it always could have been.
And I think it's nice. Well, nice. I think it's fantastic that they're doing that. They could have just said, hey, you know, that was a really neat experience. We made X millions of dollars off of selling 2 million copies. Wow. Why don't we go make something else for the rest of our lives? You know, like, you guys sure are enthusiastic about this.
And who would have blamed them after the PR disaster of the launch, you know?
Yeah, but they came back. And I think, and Sean Murray has said this as recently as March when he gave a presentation about the procedural engine. He said, this is a hobby project now. It started out as a hobby project. It launched basically bigger than we could have expected, but it's still a passion project. It's still something like we can take the money we've earned delivering the game effectively early and develop the game more. So I'm enthused. I'm really, every time the game is updated, I start over. I just start a new save because they change portions of the game everywhere.
Oh, wow. So you're not still playing the same game that you were.
Yeah.
From August of last year. Oh, wow.
No. And I thought about keeping it, like when the first big update came, I thought about keeping it. But what happened was my ship got stuck in underground on this planet because they changed the way the planet terrain generated. And because of a bug and like the exact location I had been landed in before, my ship disappeared. So I thought, well, I guess I'll have to restart. Turns out that if I had just gone to, you know, some trading post, I could have called my ship and it would have appeared and everything would have been fine. But I found that replaying that first few hours is to me one of the most fun. That tutorial level is just wild, a lot of fun for me because the planets are different every time, or different enough every time. But then they'll change a mechanic, like you can improve your ship. I talked about by getting blueprints to build. So it's a crafting mechanic where you have different elements that you gather and then you use the blueprint that you've learned to develop an improvement for your engine or an improvement for your gun or your multi-tool. Before, you could just find those blueprints anywhere, like they would show up randomly. And so you could spend the first part of the game on your home planet, gathering up all the improvements, building all the improvements, and by the time you left your planet, you were Superman, effectively, with the best ship and the best multi-tool and the best armor and all of that sort of thing. And the rest of the game was a bore, because you effectively played the entire game's game path on your first planet, and you're basically in your end game state by the time you get to the rest of the game. So they changed the pace of that by not just giving you blueprints. They'll give you a separate currency to trade with a guy on a space station to get a blueprint, which you then have to build somewhere else. So they are changing like the actual gameplay itself every time. So it's worthwhile when you see a big update like that to say, you know, maybe I should just start over because the gameplay may be completely different this time around.
So losing your ship was actually kind of liberating.
Yeah, absolutely it was. And, you know, I just enjoy, well, in fact, now there's a permadeath mode, which means if you lose your ship or you get killed falling off a cliff, then that's it. You have to start over. And that's actually my favorite mode now.
So that brings us to talking about the, well, not the ending as such, because it's, you know, it turns out it's not. And that's part of what I want to talk about. Have you found the center of a galaxy yet? Have you done that? Because that's ostensibly the aim of each galaxy, is to, you know, basically find the center of the galaxy and reach the black hole at the center of each galaxy.
Right, yeah, as effective a plot device as completing a map in Pac-Man, right? And I say that with love. There are some folks who are going to listen from the No Man's Sky fan club I'm a part of. No, I haven't. I'm still in the first galaxy. And the reason I am is that there is a group that have set up shop. One of the cool things about the game being kind of an emotionally distant mother to the players is that they have worked around a number of the tools that are kind of hinted at. Like, you can get your galactic coordinate from a specific type of building in the game. So you'll know, in theory, where your system lives in relation to other star systems. And so folks have used that to set up like a hub of where they all live, and they can interact with each other's bases. You build up a little base on your planet, and other folks can see that base and interact with it, even though they can't interact with you. So folks are setting that up. I'm heading towards one called the No Man's Sky Love Hub, which is what it says on the tin. These are, you know, guys who absolutely love the game. And so all of those guys are all in that first galaxy. All of these different hubs and communities have all taken the first galaxy. And if I go into the next one, I would have to start over to get back to the first one. So really reluctant. Like, if you really want to push and explore where almost literally nobody has gone before, because I think one person has gone to all 256 galaxies now.
Oh, really?
If you want to, yeah. It happened very recently. Apparently, it was a bug exploit where if you hit a certain key at the right time while you were coming into the next galaxy, you could immediately hop to the next one.
Oh, I see.
So he got to do that. He hit all 256 galaxies. But if you want to keep going further, like, there are fewer and fewer discovered worlds. And in the first galaxy, you will occasionally run into ones that have been discovered by somebody else, and they've named it Sean Murray Sucks or something like that. And, you know, you can like that or not like that all you want, but the further you get, the more you get to kind of own your space.
Right.
So that's tempting, but this game is a roguelike. For the concept explanation, a roguelike is randomly generated. It's supposedly a different game every time. And the whole idea of that type of game is that you play it till you die, and then you try again until you play it again and until you die. And it is meant to give you a different experience every time. So
modern gamers would probably compare it to an endless runner. I think
exactly.
That, I find that's because most people don't know what a roguelike is anymore, yes. But everybody knows what an endless runner is.
I am so old.
Oh, me too.
But yeah, exactly. So an endless runner. But when folks who first saw that, okay, you hit the center of the galaxy, and what it does is just bounce you to the next galaxy where you start over, right? So a lot of folks were super disappointed in that.
Your princess is in another galaxy.
Exactly. and it frustrated so many people, and they said, it's just like all you did was change a level, you know, and the planets are levels, and the galaxy is a big world of a collection of levels, and it just looks like a game. And I'm thinking to myself, yeah, it's a game. Just because you can see the mechanics doesn't mean it's bad, right? So, yeah, maybe they haven't, and maybe modern gamers are used to seeing their game mechanics veiled and made prettier so that you don't really feel like they're game mechanics. But to me, I thought it was very clever. It's like, well, we could do one gigantic galaxy of 18 quintillion worlds, which is in and of itself crazy. Or we can split it up over, you know, a number of galaxies that Sean Murray would say, oh, it's a big secret what happens. Like, some folks sussed it out immediately. Oh, I bet you go to another galaxy, and that's your galaxy, and you get to live in your galaxy. And some folks thought there was going to be a big plot point. I think it's all kind of where you come from as a gamer.
Right. I think the disappointment for a lot of people was that there wasn't some kind of info dump, or, you know, a big cutscene, or alien artifact that you discovered or something. It was just bounce you over, okay, off you go, another galaxy.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, again, depending on what you want to get out of this game, that's either fantastic or the worst.
Right.
Like a lot of the really cool additions that the game has brought in the last couple of expansions has been kind of around that asynchronous multiplayer. So folks are sticking around in that first galaxy. You could, for example, so you mentioned the vehicles, right? You can set up a racetrack on your planet. Only you can race on that racetrack in person, right? There's no like you and five other vehicles racing around the same track at the same time. But what folks have done is they've set up the track, told other people how to get to that planet.
And then post their times.
Yeah, they have rally races. And like, I thought that was the most fantastic creative use of, here's some game mechanics. Here is a big set of game Legos, and you can build whatever you want out of it. And folks are building these tracks and then challenging other folks that they know. And like, what it's really done, in my opinion, is by not focusing on that player versus player or that simultaneous multiplayer where people are yelling at you over chat, and you know, you get an experience that certain types of player really enjoy and certain types of player really don't enjoy. Setting up that asynchronous where nobody sees each other but they can interact has developed communities. And while we can debate whether that is intentional or not in the design of the game, the fact that the communities exist and they are generally very positive, mostly because they're the only folks that are left, is the people who love the game are the only ones playing it. You get these little pockets, and I'm heading towards one now. So,
yeah, I was going to say, when you were talking about the synchronous versus asynchronous earlier, that is one, to my mind, advantage of the asynchronous stuff, is that you just know that if you did have synchronous multiplayer, if you could actually physically see other players at the same time as you, it would turn into EVE Online.
Oh yeah, you know, absolutely.
It would just become everybody griefing and shooting and fighting everybody else. And you're right, some people like that, but there are already many, many games for people who like that sort of gameplay.
Exactly.
And this is clearly not meant to be one of them. And so in one respect, this game looks very much up my alley. But on the other hand, while I was watching those videos, I just kind of felt like there was a lot of grinding. And grinding is something that I really, really hate in adventure games.
Oh, man.
You know, the idea that you've got to go around shooting rocks to gather minerals to repair to refuel your jetpack, and just for heaven's sake.
Well, okay, so there's a couple of interesting things, and one of them is that it is, if you want to get all the upgrades, if you want to do a bunch of stuff, you grind. And a lot of those early videos were very grindy because of what I was talking about, how it was so easy to get all the materials to do it, so you just did it.
Mm-hmm.
And then now they pace it out differently so that it takes a heck of a lot longer to even encounter a recipe to build. One thing that's really great is they have a creative mode now, which sets all the fuel and resource requirements to zero.
Oh.
And so it is a walking simulator. Like, the mechanics are all there. You still have to repair your ship and all of that sort of thing, but everything's free, so you just build it. It takes away a lot of that grind. So if you did just want to experience the game as the best screenshot simulator in the world and an aesthetic experience, you can get creative mode. Just run it. It's a separate save. So if you wanted to do something else later, you're not losing it.
And that's like endless fuel for your ship and stuff as well.
Exactly. Yeah.
So you can just fly wherever you want, walk around, fly somewhere else. Oh, okay. That actually sounds right up my alley.
Yeah. It is a ton of fun. And also, I would say most of the players who post videos hate the speed the game runs at, how slow it is. And so they do like flying everywhere. They'll fly in their ship everywhere. To me, the real beauty of the game is you land on the planet, and basically my personal goal, and I wish you could track this, like, you know how NetHack has all of those different, like, I've never killed an animal, I've never used a spell or that sort of tracking. I wish there was land on a planet once, because if you land on a planet once and wander everywhere and then go back to your ship and leave, like, to me, I think that is the garden path experience that Sean wanted to have, because the interesting monuments or interaction points are all spread about 3 minutes apart. So they're randomly distributed, but they're all about 3 minutes apart. So when you get to one, you can just detect the next one on the horizon about 2.5 minutes away. And it's meant to kind of draw you away from your ship and towards the next interesting thing to encounter, whether it's a trading post or a monument or, just some save point, even like with some artifacts that are interesting. So I have found myself where I'll land, I'll see a mountain in the distance, and I'll say, you know, let's climb that mountain. And as I'm spending the 20 minutes it takes to walk to that mountain, I'll hit every pit stop on the way, which kind of turns that straight path into a diagonal, zigzaggy one. And I think that's really the sweet spot of the game, is walking, not running, not flying, not, you know, puddle hopping.
Not rushing.
Not rushing. Everybody wants to rush through a game. They saw all those blueprints. They saw the mechanics, and they said, I got to get this done as fast as possible so I have the coolest stuff as much as possible. Like, the game has no set philosophy. You are bringing your philosophy to the game. So if you...
Right, it is what you make of it.
If you are total type A, this game is going to give you the type A experience until it's run out of stuff, and then you have to look at your life and go, oh crap, you know, I acquired all this currency and I acquired all this stuff, and the game still goes, now what? You know, whereas if you play like a space hobo and only gather what you need and then, you know, and wander around and just take in the scenery, like, I think that experience is so much more fulfilling out of this game. I think the game is designed to give you that. Every time before the game came out, every time Sean Murray mentioned the word multiplayer, I would cringe, because I was really hoping that this would be a 100% single player game. Like, the only question I had was, can I turn it off offline and just play it myself without seeing...
Without ever meeting another player, yeah.
Yeah, like, when he said that you could name planets and other people would see that you named the planets, that was like a huge disappointment for me. I was like, no, I really don't want to see, I'm awesome as, you know, the name, unless I said that, right? Like, I want that. So that the multiplayer giveth and taketh away, you know, that sort of culture you get is a certain type of culture. And whether you want to participate in that or not is kind of like, that drives what kind of interactions you want. I think, luckily, Sean Murray holds a lot of similar opinions to me, which makes me very happy in that multiplayer space. And the style of almost multiplayer that they have is one of my favorite things, except for all the Sean Murray sucks planets.
All right, so in closing, I mean, some people out there, probably most of our listeners, probably don't already own this game, you know, haven't played it. Some of them maybe have, and, you know, many of them, as you say, may have played it once and then realized that a lot of the stuff they were supposedly promised, you know, was not in there, and just put it down again. So what would you say to encourage people to either pick it up for the first time, or if they have picked it up, played it and put it aside, to put it back in the PS4 or, you know, back on Steam or whatever, and give it another go?
I think the game has changed in fundamental ways. If you are new to the game, you can successfully divorce the game that is now from what the game was. So you can say the game that was doesn't exist anymore. You can play the game now, and it's on sale a lot more now. You can get it for as low, I've seen it as low as £19 in Britain and, you know, $25 in the US.
All right.
Just depending. And you can get it used and it'll update for free. Like this content that has come in is all free. So buy it cheap, low investment for you, and give it 5 hours, you know. And if you are an old player who's racked up a bunch of money and are bored with the game, start over. Put it back in, let it update, start the game over, and just play 5 hours. And I think the pacing of the game is so much better now. The way the game presents itself to you is a little more mature and confident mechanically, that you'll either enjoy it or you won't. But I think you can make a smaller investment now than that $60 price tag or that $100 limited edition price tag that they were giving us back in August. So, and it is a niche game that happened to sell millions of copies. So if you don't like it, that's okay. Like, sell it back to GameStop or whatever, but give it five. Give it five good hours of your time, and I think you'll really enjoy it. If you find yourself walking over a hill and you see something really cool, just let yourself enjoy that aesthetic experience, because that's really what it's about. People call walking simulators, you know, that's kind of a pejorative in the gaming industry, but this is the biggest walking simulator, where you can just walk around and relax after a hard day of work.
I really like a lot of walking simulators, frankly, and games like that. I'm very into the indie space these days. All right, Matt, where can people find you if they like what you have to say about ambient sci-fi games?
Oh, my God. I don't have much of a social media presence. I am willing to completely ruin my inbox and give you my email address, though.
All right, go for it.
RadioCaravan@gmail.com. is my email address. I'm not even on Twitter. God, what have I done?
You're not on Twitter? Wow.
Well, I have a very, very small account with one follower that I use to follow basketball players that I like. That's about it.
Creative uses of Twitter. I like it.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, Matt. Thanks very much for coming on the show.
Thank you so much, Anthony.
Thanks for listening to Unjustly Maligned. You can check out my other work, including comics, books, music, and more, at anthonyjohnston.com, where you'll find more information about all of my work. You can support Unjustly Maligned by becoming a member of the Incomparable Network. Go to theincomparable.com/members to sign up, and check the box for Unjustly Maligned when you choose which shows to support. You can also help by reviewing Unjustly Maligned on iTunes and following us on Twitter at UMPFM. And the show notes for this episode are at ump.fm. Unjustly Maligned is a 7RQ production for The Incomparable and is made in England. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time. One thing that I saw was promised that didn't materialize, which I thought was a real shame, was that, and I say promised again, this is a bit of a modern moment in that, you know, he said it during an interview, but Sean Murray said that the planet, the day-night cycles on the planets would be driven by actual celestial physics, that, yeah, you know, planets would rotate around a sun, and that would determine, you know, the speed of their rotation and the angle of their rotation would determine the night-day cycle, you know, on the planet while you were walking around it, rather than some silly skybox. And of course, that's none of that's in there, and it's just a silly skybox. Which is fine, you know, who cares? Skyboxes are fine. They're in every game ever made since Quake. You know, but it is a shame, because it would be really nice to have actual orbital mechanical physics going on to determine that.
Yeah, I, you know, in some ways I really agree with that. Like, it would be the coolest thing that they all actually did what they were supposed to do in physical space. And the skybox, so you get a 30 minute day night cycle. It's 20 minutes day, 10 minutes of night. So in that respect, like, there is a mechanic at least that you can kind of time how you're doing on the game. But it is like clockwork, 20 minutes of day, 10 minutes of night, or around there.
And is that every planet?
It is every planet that I've been on that I've. And so, yeah, you know, OK, the skybox at least is populated with the stars you would see from your point in the galaxy.
OK, well, that's good, at least.
That's cool, I think. And you when you land, it's generally always 4 minutes before sunset. So you get a sunset and a night cycle early on in the game. So like a lot of games that are not procedurally generated do, like Horizon Zero Dawn, right? They do a ton of stuff and look at all the lines and basically make the game a virtual theme park, like a virtual Disneyland, where you are always going to get this perfect, better than real life experience every time you enter an area or exist in that level. And while you can't really get a guarantee of that experience in a procedural game, because that planet could be utterly boring, to a certain player, like you are, yeah. Here are the planets, love them or leave them.
But they can at least fix it so you always get a nice sunset.
Yeah, exactly. You are going to get a sunset 4 minutes into landing on that planet. So you are always going to experience a sunset 4 minutes into that planet. And that's neat. Like 4 minutes, you are going to spend 10 minutes on the planet, like for sure. Just getting out, wandering around a little, getting the resources you need, and then leaving. And so you are going to at least see a star field and the sunset, and you get the different colors because it, you know, the color palettes shift. And so it's trying its hardest to give you that theme park experience that all video games are really actually doing. My parents have played 40 hours and they're still on the first planet, and it's just driving me bonkers because it's like, Dad, I know you're driving, but we got to get you off this planet. We got to get you to the next one. Like, are you bored with this planet? He's like, yeah, I'm kind of bored. It's like, come on, just leave. Don't be so small town, man. It doesn't matter what planet you find that monument on. You're always going to get the next monument in line.
Oh, okay. Well, that's good. Yeah.
Yeah. So if you see 15 monuments on one planet, you get story pieces 1 through 15. But you could have gotten story pieces 1 through 15 guaranteed on 15 different planets.
Right. You know? The Arkham games, I think, were the first big games to use that approach with lore and story pieces. Mm-hmm. And I've ever since, when I basically realized that that's what was happening in, I think it might have been the second Arkham game where they did that. And as soon as I realized that that was what they were doing, I was a convert immediately, because I suddenly realized why my game experience had felt so much better than the first one.
Because you're not missing anything.
Right, exactly. It's not forcing you to go to a place where the only reason for you to go there is to get a piece of lore information.
Exactly.
And I really, really, I was just grateful for that decision. So I actually try to do that. I advocate for that in games that I work on now as well. If there are any
good.
Similar sort of, oh, okay, we've got 12 pieces of lore that we want the player to find, I advocate for, well, let's just make sure that they always find them in the correct order, no matter which actual physical artifact they find. They just get the next piece in the puzzle. I think that's such a better way of doing it.
And that's exactly what that first trailer for Spore was. Not Spore. Oh, my God. can I get a do-over on that one?
Radio Caravan? Where does that come from?
That actually was the podcasting syndicate I tried to do 10 years ago.
Oh.
I thought in 2006 or 2007, I thought, wouldn't it be awesome if you treated podcasts like a radio station or a TV station, and you had different shows that were all in the syndicate, and then everybody could like get each other's listeners, and wouldn't that be awesome?
Yeah, ahead of your time.
I was ahead of my time. Now I'm just trying to squeak in as a guest.
People were treating Sean Murray's appearances, you know, like criminology. I'll say that again. My God.